So good evening, everyone. Welcome to our 11th installment in the exciting book of Samuel Sefer Shmuel. So in order to contextualize this evening, where we're going to meet the first king of Israel, Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, momentarily, we want to have a little background into what transpired in chapter 8, Perek Chet, that we last learned a couple weeks back. We learned that the nation of Israel grew tired of Samuel's two sons, who were not up to the task of taking over the mantle from their father Shmuel when the aged Samuel was no longer able to bring justice to all to the people. They remained stoic and with stasis in mind as they basically lived in Beersheba and Beersheba in the south of Israel, and all the people were forced to come to them. And they created an entire judicial infrastructure, we said, and the Torah unfortunately condemns them, and this is Samuel's words, as if they actually took shochat, bribery, God forbid. We said, no, that was not the case, but rather, they, by not taking the justice on the road and forcing the people to come to them, they created an economy, if you will, for the infrastructure that was set up for them in Beersheba, and the Torah, because of the great elevated status of the sons of Shmuel, treats them as if they actually became corrupt, which they weren't. However, the people became fed up. They come to Samuel, Shmuel, and Avi, and they say, look, it's time to end the figurehead shofet judge. It's time for a melech. We want a king. We want to be like all the other nations around us. He will fight for us. He'll make wars. Look how successful all the other wonderful dictatorships are in the world. So we want this. Samuel's very upset. His nose is out of joint because he says, wait a minute. What about me? I'm still alive and kicking. I'm your shofet. I'm your judge. I'm your navi. It's a rejection of me. God says, Shmuel, relax. Ultimately, it's a rejection of me, the king of kings. Who makes wars and wins wars for the Jewish people? Is it not me, God says? So relax, Shmuel. And warn the people. Give them hatra'ah. Admonish them that if they are desirous of a king, these are the rules that they're going to have to deal with, not only now, but forever, because it's not a cult of personality where we select a leader. A king becomes king generationally, and there's no going back. We're not going to allow the people, you should have invoked the Egyptian clause, right? You know, the 13 months after the Brotherhood came to power, the Egyptians all put up their hands, remember, after the evil Morsi and the Islamic Brotherhood, they said, no, we didn't really want to elect these bunch of whacked out terrorists. Bring back the regime, right? And for them, they were lucky. They had a guy, General Sisi, who brings back to power, you know, what Mubarak had brought and Sadat. But you're not going to have that option, essentially, God says to Samuel, to tell the people. So he goes in front of the people. He says, you guys want a melech? Fine. Here's the rule. And he goes through a whole litany of things, powers. The king can essentially take your lands, eminent domain, your children. He likes your children, he'll pay them and they'll work for him. The women in the bakeries and in the restaurants, the guys that will be running in front of his chariots and in the army, he'll conscript them, he'll pay them, yes, but they're your lovely men and women. The choicest of the choice will belong to the king, and you have no right of refusal. How do you like it? The people, though, were so invested in the idea of a monarch, of a melech, to emulate the goye Ha'olam, the nations of the world, they even interrupt Samuel literally as he's speaking and say, no, we want the king. So God says, okay, no worries. Oh, by the way, Samuel says, guys, you can go home now. Meaning, there's nobody here that's a candidate to be king. You all, in your inflated egos, believed maybe one of you would be deserving of the mantle to be the melech. Guess what? Bye, go home. Okay, this is where we have to contextualize with a very sad, horrific chapter in Jewish history, and for us to understand the profundity of what it means for Saul, Shaul, to be chosen. Yep, we have to backtrack. At the beginning of Samuel, we said, there was a monumental paradigmatic shift between the time of the Shoftim, the judges, and in the book of Samuel, we transition to a time of not only prophets, the Nevi'im, but the kings. And the words that close Sefer Shoftim, the book of Judges, that there is no king, Ein Melech, there's no king among the Jews. And if you go back just a few chapters, at the beginning of the sordid story that I'm going to recount for you, cliff note style, thankfully, It also says there was no king among the Jews. And it prepares us for a horrific story. It's called Pelegesh, a concubine, Begiva, in this area called Giva, this little horrific area in the tribe of Benjamin's territory. So here's the sad story, okay? There was a man who had a Pelegesh, a concubine. It's a debate whether she was married to him or by law or not. She apparently committed adultery and ran away from this guy. He pursued her, caught up to her, they made amends, he's bringing her back. They come through the tribe of Benjamin. And if you remember the story of Lot and his situation in Sodom when the two angels visit him, it's almost word for word the same sordid story. What happens is they are desirous of a place to sleep during the night. So they come, this old man invites them, he says, it's not safe to stay on the road in Giva, there are dangerous characters lurking out there, so come stay by me. And sure enough, knock comes on the door, the citizens of Giva and the tribe of Benjamin say, hey, where's the stranger, meaning the man that came to you? We want to know him, biblically. Just like what happened in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah when they tried to essentially get their hands on the two angels, remember? And then Lot courageously stands up to them and offers up his two daughters. Exactly the same thing. The old man says, well, look, you can't have the man. I mean, that's homosexuality, and we know that's off the charts. But how about you rape my virginal daughter, and we'll throw the concubine out to you? I mean, it's nuts, okay? So they take a look at the concubine, and oh, she's attractive, she's nice. So they don't even want the virginal daughter, so they just take the concubine belonging to this poor guy. And she is, shall we say, raped all night long. In the morning, she staggers to the door. She drops dead on the door, on the stoop, literally there by the door. And it's a horrific story. The man, who obviously had his issues also, the husband, shall we say, of the concubine, is so irate. This is where it gets a little graphic, and I apologize, okay? He takes her body, and he dismembers her into 12 pieces after she's dead, obviously. And he's basically UPSs the pieces of her body to the 12 tribes of Israel, not including Benjamin. So we're including the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, as half tribes. And he says, look, you cannot have a whole body when you have one part of the body, a hand or a leg, that is wounded, that is gross, that is, you know, essentially about to grow, grow some type of disease. You can't have a diseased limb and think it's a holistic vision. So the 12 pieces represent the 12 tribes of Israel as a collective unit. And he's saying essentially there's a diseased limb here. Benjamin has a disease in their limb. You need to do something about it. This is what happened to my poor wife, the concubine. So he dispatches it. The tribes are irate. And they all gather together and they make essentially a civil war against the tribe of Benjamin. And they are determined to essentially vanquish them. First they ask for simply the perpetrators. They said, send us the perpetrators, we'll take care of them. The Benjaminites, some of them who are corrupt themselves, say, well, wait a minute, let's discuss this. No, there's no discussion. We're not going to enter into dialogue. We want them or else. To make a long story short, there's 3 days of conflict. The first 2 days, the small minority tribe of Benjamin stands up and actually defeats the overwhelming masses of the other tribes. Then on the third day, they ask the important question to the Urim Batumim, to the breastplate. We spoke about this in the time of Eli. Remember where he misinterpreted the intentions of the prayers of Hannah. And they said, well, if we go out today and fight, this is day 3, are we going to win today? That was the question, right? It's one thing to say, should we go out and play? Should we go out and fight? Will we win? So they're assured of victory. They go out. They're ready to literally commit genocide and wipe out the entire of Benjamin. They spare Benjamin, but they make a rule. Nobody marries anybody from Benjamin. So it's a whole long story, but if we do this, Benjamin will be extinguished. The 12 tribes of Israel will never be. And so they allow Benjamin to survive. And it ends again with the idea that there's no king in Israel. Perhaps had they had hadracha, had they had from above leadership, the implication is that this entire sordid story would have been handled differently, and maybe the people, the breakdown of the anarchy that happened in this horrific place in Benjamin may not have happened. Now, you may ask, well, why did God allow this whole thing to happen? Well, God's not very happy because he says, wait a minute, let me get this right. A woman has this horrific thing happen to her and you guys get outraged, rightly so. You guys are all involved with the idolatry of Micah, of the Pesel Micha, which is an affront to me, God, that you don't get bent out of shape over and go to war. You don't attempt to take from within you the idolatrous roots and try to repair them. No, no, no. But when someone human has an issue, so then you all fight and kill each other. What about my honor? So we see again, there's a disconnect between the Jewish people and God and the Jewish people. Now, why is this crucial? What would be the last place, now that I've shared this horrific sort of story, I'm sorry about that, I see some of your faces are like, holy smokes, that was like way off the charts, okay? I apologize. You can read it in the book of Judges, I think somewhere around chapter 16, 17 to the end. So you can go home, that's a little homework, you can read it yourself if you're desirous. I would not recommend it, okay? I gave you the cleaned up, you know, PG-13 version. There's much worse. You're thinking, what? Okay, trust me. Okay. Who would be the last person on earth to supply the first king of Israel? Benjamin, maybe? Benjamin? After a civil war, after their own people are so corrupt and deviant as to do this horrific, horrific nightmarish rape and murder of this young lady, this concubine, Pelegish Bigiba, so you're going to select the first king of Israel from Benjamin? Benjamin? What? Yeah. Exactly what's going to happen, as we're going to see tonight. So that gives you context to the almost unthinkable. Who would be the logical choice to be the first king of Israel? Judah, right? Yehuda. Lo yasir shevet miYisrael. The scepter shall never be removed from Judah. But that's once they begin as kings. That's going to start with David HaMelech, King David, a little later on in our book of Samuel. But the first king is going to come from Benjamin. His name is Shaul. So let's talk about Shaul for a moment. His name has two possible meanings. Shoel, to be asked for, requested. He was improperly requested for on behalf of the Jewish people. The other is Shaul, which means to be rented out. So number one, you get something that's asked for, but something that is rented. It's just a temporary situation. Meaning, when the legitimate kings of Israel from Judah take over, that's going to be for the rest of generations. Temporarily, Saul will be the king, the first king, but he'll be both borrowed and asked for. Neither a good thing for his long-term longevity. And the rabbis ask, well, what if Saul hadn't messed up? What if the things that will happen to poor Saul later in his life never happened? Would he have been legitimately the king of Israel? The answer is yes. Perhaps ruling over the tribes of Rachel's children, over the tribe of Manasseh, Ephraim, and Benjamin, right? But, unfortunately, as we're going to see, he's a very tragic, tragic figure. The most humble, most honest, the greatest of people who is going to have a fall of nightmarish proportions. But, even though I'm giving you foreshadowing, when we meet him tonight, and as we enjoy him for the next couple of chapters, marvelous, marvelous human being, as you will see. An amazing person, which I think is going to make his fall from grace all the more sad and tragic and profound. Let's begin, please. Perek Tet, chapter 9. So you ask for a king. Samuel, you're going to meet the man. So, Pasuk Aleph. Vayehi ish mibinyamin. There was a certain man from the tribe of Benjamin. Ushmo Kish. His name was Kish. Ben Aviel, the son of Aviel. Ben Sror, grandson of Sror. Ben Bechorat's giving you all the genealogy of Saul. Ben Afiach, Ben Ish Yemini, a man from Benjamin. Gibor Chayil, who was this distinguished Benjaminite and a mighty man of valor, meaning either wealth, might in terms of military might, or both. Now, what's really beautiful is it says, let's look at his genealogy again. Ish mi Binyamin ushmo Kish. And Kish, who's the father of Saul, by the way, Shaul, it's his dad, is the Ben Aviel. The only problem is, in the book of Chronicles, when it talks about the lineage of Saul, it says he wasn't the son of Kish, son of Aviel. He was the son of Kish, who was the son of a man named Ner. A Ner, of course, is a light. So the rabbi says something gorgeous here. Beautiful. His grandfather, Aviel, was really Aviel, but he was known by the name, nickname, the euphemism, Ner, the light. Why? Because every evening, as it got dark, he would go out and he would light up with torches, with lamps, the way to synagogue and the way for people to get home safely at night. So because he sacrificed and cared so much about the people, this man became the grandfather of Shaul, the first king of Israel, because at its core, what does a king supply for the people? Light, identity, and care for the masses. The king himself does not have his own identity, his own power. He is supposed to be an extension, emergent from the will of the people. So Saul became Saul because his Zadi, Aviel, lit up the way for the people. So it's a very, very beautiful mita keneged mita, measure for measure reward, given to the family of this man, Aviel. Doc.
His name is Father of God.
Kel here really means, doesn't necessarily mean God, it means like a power. Right. No, you're right, it's a contraction or not a contraction. Very well said. Okay, very well said. Pasuk Beis, second verse. Ve'lo hayavein. And this man, Kish, had a son, Ushmo Shaul. His name was Saul. Again, the connotation both of borrowed and asked for, requested for. Bahur, he was exceptional, but tov, and good. The Ein Ish mi b'nei Yisrael tov mimeno. There was no one else among all the Jewish people more handsome and better, greater, in terms of righteousness, perhaps, than he was. Mishichmo v'mala, from his shoulders on up. You know the expression, he's head and shoulders above everyone else? This is the source. He was head and shoulders, literally and metaphorically, above all the other individuals. Mikola'am, from all the other people. He was literally taller, as we're going to learn, tall and handsome. But he was metaphorically head and shoulders above everyone else. Mr. Birma.
Don't we hear the name Kish? In regards to Mordechai?
Mordechai is from Benjamin, and we say Ben Kish, yes, but it's a different one. I mean, it's the same family. Very good, very good. I'm very impressed. And that's Benjamin, correct?
Well, yeah.
Very, very good. And you know what else is unique about Mordechai? Which is germane to tonight. Thank you, Mr. Birma, for giving me that entree. You know what's fascinating about Mordechai? We spoke about the kings of Israel. So you have the first king, which is Benjamin. We're introduced to this man, Mordechai, as an Ish Yemini, a man of Benjamin. But that's at the end of the verse. Do you remember how we are introduced to him in the beginning of the first verse? We say this verse out loud when we meet Mordechai in the book of Esther. By the way, we're going to begin that, please God, in a couple of weeks together as a special little Purim delight. We say, Ish Yehudi Hayah B'Shushan Habira. A man of Judah lived in Shushan, the capital city. And then it goes on to tell us his genealogy. Ish Yemini, a man of Benjamin. What? You can't be a man of Judah and a man of Benjamin and be one in the same. Well, yeah, he could. Both. He incorporated both the Judah aspect and the Benjamin aspect, which are the two kingships of Israel. Correct? Benjamin, Saul, Judah, David, become one in the persona of this marvelous individual, Mordechai. So it's very, very interesting.
You trace them both, bring him back to both?
Right. Absolutely. So he's unique. He's unique. Let's carry on. Weiter. So this young man, Shaul, is exceptional. Exceptional young man. Verse 3. Pasuk Gimel. Vatovadna ha'asonos l'kishavi Shaul. So Kish, the father of Shaul, apparently had a nice collection of beautiful vintage automobiles. Well, they're known as she-donkeys back then, but the same idea. They were like Jaguars in the time of, you know, people bought them and traded them, right? They leased them, right? They were beautiful. So a couple of the choicest she-donkeys belonging to Kish, father of Shaul, were lost. They went farblunjet. They went missing. Vayomer Kish ha-Shaul l'bana. So Kish says to Saul, his son, Kachna itcha. Please take with you now, es achad me hani'arim, one of the youths, one of the young men, one of the servants, but kum leich, get up and go, bakeshes asanos, go search for the donkeys. Stop for a second. Now, Kish is a multimillionaire. He has Jaguars, beautiful cars, donkeys, he's got it all. He's also got a ton of servants. So you send the prince, the young Saul, out on a mission which could be perilous? Really?
The father's teaching the son responsibility.
Okay, that's good.
Trump has his sons running and they're running the business.
So the rabbis say, though, that the idea was planted into Kish's mind to effect, as we will see, Saul's destiny. Can anyone remember another father who sent his most beloved son in the craziest scenario when he also had 1,000 servants to send on a perilous journey, never saw his son for 22 years? Jacob. Jacob sent Joseph. Correct? Again, who planted the idea in Jacob's mind? Send Joseph to the brothers, knowing how the brothers feel? Really, you're going to jeopardize Joseph's life? Again, it's planted there by God. Okay? So let's go weiter. So Shaul is sent on this mission with one of the other youths, one of the other lads. And so it says, he travels everywhere, north, south, east, and west. So first, he goes to Mount Ephraim, passed through the land of Shalisha. He didn't find the donkeys. And again, he passes through the land of Shalim, that are not there. And he goes to the land of the Benjaminites. He doesn't find them there. Then he and the young man, the servant who works for his father, come to the land of Tsuf. I'll explain what that means in a moment. The Shaul amar l'na'aro asher imah. So then Saul says to the young lad who's with them, L'chavin ha-shuva. You know, let's go back to dad. Let's go back home. You know why? Pen yaktala vi min ha-asonos v'da'aglanu. You know, by now our dad's going to get worried about us. He's going to say, well, wait a minute. Forget about the donkeys. Where's Shaul? Where's Saul? It's been all these many days we haven't heard from him. So he's going to worry more about us, our fate, than the fate of the donkeys.
Oh.
But in this, the rabbis point to something very subtle in the text to show you the greatness and humility of Saul. Look at the last words. He says to the young man at the end of verse 5, Pasakei, he says, Pen, lest, Yechdal avi mehasonos, our father will stop thinking about the lost donkeys, the da'ag, and worry, lanu. But it shouldn't say lanu, it should say li. About me! He doesn't care about you, you're just a servant. No. Saul did not place himself above his fellow Eved, the servant who was working for his dad. Because of this humility, this perspective he had, in other words, he equated his loss to the loss of the servant and the worry that dad might have, even though clearly dad's not going to be too worried about the servant the way he would be for his own son. Doesn't matter. This is one of the reasons Chazal point to, the rabbis point to, for why Saul merited to become the king of Israel. Again, a king is not allowed to have me. It has to be all about the nation. Now, how can I prove this? Because a king may never say to you, don't honor me. Never. Everyone else the Gemara goes through, a litany, rabbis, princes, every great person potentially is allowed to say, I'm machal on my kavod. I'm giving away my honor. Don't stand for me. But when a melech, a king of Israel, says, don't stand for me, you have to ignore him. Why? Because he has no right to say, I'm giving away my honor. The honor doesn't belong to him anymore. It belongs to the people. So for him to give up the honor is a disgrace and disparagement of the entirety of the nation. Therefore, a king has no self anymore. Now, you might say, but Rabbi, this is not the way kings really operate. You're right. It's not the practical application. When a person becomes a king, but in a Jewish utopian world, this is what a king is supposed to be, an emergent property on behalf of the people, an expression of the people.
The royal way. You always have a royal way.
Sure. But remember, again, and we spoke about this with the House of Windsor, correct?
Right.
The House of Windsor have no practical power in England. In fact, they worry, right, lest the British people kind of think too much about how much they're getting paid or how much it costs.
They just own it.
Right? They want to sort of keep in mind you dare not dishonor the House of Windsor. I mean, I guess there's been a kind of problems over the last 20 years, but you know this is a major issue, right? That they have to be on the, beyond the appearance of impropriety, because less people think we don't need them anymore. They're just figureheads anyways. And if they're going to just dishonor us in such a way, what do we need them for, right? That's why they're very careful. They're very makbid. They're very selective in who they allow and how you present yourself in public and what you may or may not do. Okay? But the same thing here with the king. A king does not have a self to give over. Okay. So Saul says, I think we should go back home. Now, where are they? We said they're in Eretz Tsuf. So the word suf comes from the Lashon of mitzapeh, to have visions, to watch. And it was called suf because there was one man, coincidentally, who lived in this area in Mount Ramasaim Sofim, the elevated area of the seers. Guess who it was? Samuel. So in honor of Samuel living in this area, the entire designation became Eretz Suf, the land of the prophets, the land of the seers. That happened to be coincidentally, which we don't believe in, where Saul and the young men found themselves. So since they're there, they have a great idea. Verse 6. So Vayomer lo. And so the young man says to Saul, Shaul, the young master, Hineina ish Elokim ba'ir hasos. You know, I've heard that there is a man of God, meaning Samuel, who happens to live in this very city where we coincidentally find ourselves. And Va'ish nichbad, that man is the most esteemed, most honored, kavod. Kol asher yidaber bo yavo. And every single thing he says always comes to pass. Ata, now, nechasham. Let's go there. We're right there. Ulaya gilana, maybe he will tell us, Estarkenu asher alakno aleho, the journey that we should go upon, where we're going to find those lost donkeys. He'll definitely help us. No worries. All right.
That is a silly question.
Yes.
How many miles? It sounds like they went all over Israel looking for donkeys.
They spent a few days going. They went north, south, east, and west. They did.
Yeah, they did.
It's not that big of a place.
No, it really isn't. This is what they call the pre-Green Line,
yeah.
Right?
You're not a couple of hours.
It's about 9 miles across, right? Vayomer, that's right. They had Google Maps.
The south is a good 25 miles.
Vayomer Shaul Anaro. So Saul says to the young man, to the youth, he said, you know, it's a great idea. Okay, but if we go, Manavilaish, what are we going to bring the man as a gift? You know, he's like little, you remember in the Peanuts, Lucy, you know, 5 cents the psychiatrist is in? So a Navi is going to have at least 5 cents. You got to give him a couple shekel here or there in order to do his Navi stuff for you, you know, like Madame Zushka. You got to throw her a couple of shekels and she'll tell you the future. So we don't have a lot on us, Shoal says. I maxed out on my credit cards. I have nothing. Manavilish, what do we have to give to the man to bring to him? Ki alechem azal mikeleno, because we've already used up all our food in our journey. And we don't have any gift to bring to the man of God. So what should we bring him? My tana, what do we have left? Ah, by Yosef and Narla and Osashol. So the young, very bright young man says, again, he continues to answer Saul. He says, Vayomer. He says, you know what? I got a quarter. I have a quarter of a silver shekel. You know, 25 cents. Good deal. Right, inflation time. Okay, we're adjusting for box office inflation. Then Asati Elisha Elokim, I will give the quarter to the man of God, the Higid Lanu Estarkeinu, and then he'll definitely inform us of our way. Let's stop for a second. Now, does Shaul accept money? We learnt in the previous chapter, Shaul accepted zero. He was a wealthy man who was so careful about the appearance of impropriety, that even if you gave him a donation, he wouldn't accept it because he was a man of means. Because he didn't want any influence peddling, correct? But obviously in the minds of Shaul and the young man, it was a prerequisite. Well, why should this be so? Well, I have an answer for you. Do you remember when Yitzchak, Isaac, sent Esau out on a little mission? He says, I'll bless you, but first go get me some, remember? Go get me some food that I love. Prepare it the way I love it. Bring it to me. I'll give you a bracha. But the blessing that Isaac's going to give to Esau is the blessing, right? It's not just a generic blessing. It's a blessing of Abraham, all the spirit, the heritage of the Jewish people is going to be given to Esau. So it's a nevius. It's a prophecy. It gives us the future. So in order for the focus of the Navi, of the would-be prophet, to have you and you alone in mind, they want to feel beholden to you. So if they owe you, in other words, if you give them a nice meal, then they can focus their nevius, their prophetic powers totally on you, because now they're indebted to you. So in the same way that Isaac asked Esav first for food before he sort of tapped into the God powers, the at least in the minds of Saul and the young man, it was customary for the average generic prophet to have a little bit of a you know, not that he needs the food or the money, but it will enable him to focus on you and be a better prophet. Samuel, of course, would refuse. They didn't know this. Okay? So let's carry on. So they said, this is a great idea. Let's go find him. So we're in Pasuk number 10, number 9. Lifanim. You know, many years before, in the old days, when this text was written, this is a very strange pasuk. Let me preface this. This verse is so out of context that it clearly wasn't written by Samuel himself. So there are disputes. Who is the author? Now remember I mentioned to you that Samuel never lived to finish the book? It was clearly finished by Natan HaNavi, Nathan the prophet, or, who was the great prophet in the time of David, of King David, or God HaRoeh, God the seer. Or, some say Ezra HaSofer, that Ezra the scribe in later generations added this. Now what is this pasuk? It's a very strange verse. This is sort of like a little sideline, a little soliloquy off the, you know, by the way, for those of you who are learning at the class, and you're a little like flummoxed by the term Navi, like what is a prophet? Well, guess what? In the old days, what they used to refer to as this, today we call this. It's a very strange verse. Clearly not written by Shmuel, by Samuel himself, as you'll see. Let's just read it. Very strange verse. Okay, in fact, if you read this without any parish, without any commentary, it's very strange. Lifanim. Once upon a time, formerly Beisrael, in the old days in Israel, many moons ago, in other words, in the time of Samuel, Ko amar ha'ish belechto lidrosh Elokim. When someone said that I will go inquire of God, I will ask a Navi to help me. L'chu v'nelcho ad ha-ro'eh. They would say, let's go to the ro'eh, the seer, the one who can see the future. That's what they used to say. Ki l'navi hayom, and what today, in other words, many years later, in our generation, we refer to today as a Navi, yikare l'fanim ha-ro'eh. In those old days, when the book of Samuel was written, they used to call a Navi a ro'eh. They never called them a Navi, a prophet. They would call them the seer. You notice how it's parenthetical in your English? Mm-hmm. Did you notice that, anyone who has the book? Because this verse doesn't really belong here. It's to contextualize, I guess, for the purpose of the people learning this Sefer in times, modern times, quote unquote, many years later, to understand what the difference is in a roeh. Who is a roeh? What do you mean a seer? A visionary? So they're the same thing, in other words. A roeh, Navi, and Navi is a roeh. So the Navi goes out of his way here, not Samuel, but we're talking years later. We're going backwards and inserting this verse, which is really not written here by Samuel. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay, let's go weiter. Let's go on. So now back into our story. Verse Yud, Pasuk 10. Vayomer Shaul l'Navi. Good, he says. Tov, Devarcha. Your words are good, young man. You are very bright. Let's go. Come on. Let's get to see this, the Roeh, the seer. So they go into the city. Asher Sham Ish HaElokim, where this man of God was located. Now let's just stop for a second. Do you think it's coincidental that the donkeys are lost? And the donkeys draw them to the city where just b'mikra, just coincidentally, Samuel happens to be there. You think it's all by chance? Obviously not, as we'll see. Hema Olim v'Maale Ha'ir. So the two young men, they, Saul and his servant, went up into the high part of the city. Vehema matsu na'arot. And they find a gaggle of giggling young girls. Try saying that a couple times. Giggling young ladies, na'arot. These gaggle of beautiful young ladies are yotza'ot. They're leaving the city, lishav mayim, to draw water. Vayomru lahen, so Saul and the young man asked the young ladies, Hayesh bazeh haro'eh? Is this where the seer is? Is the seer in town or is he out of town? Now this is really interesting. The next verse you almost see, and it's meant this way by Samuel, by design, okay? If you read it really carefully, it's like there are three or four different dialogues going on between the young girls and their answers to Saul and the young man. It's almost like, that's why I said the gaggle of giggling girls. They are speaking, but they're almost like speaking breathlessly, and each one has like a different thing to add, a different detail. So I'll just read it in English because it's kind of fun to read in English, okay? So they answered him saying, "It is. Behold, he is just ahead of you. Hurry now, for he came to the city today, where the people are bringing a feast offering today at the high place. As you enter the city, you will find him before he ascends to the high place to eat, for the people will not eat before he comes, since he blesses the offering. Only afterwards do the invited guests eat. Now go up, for you will find him as surely as it is day." It's very strange. It's like this very disjointed conversation. The rabbis have a lot of fun here. Okay, first of all, the rabbis say, this is the funny part. The girls were so smitten with the gorgeous young man named Saul standing in front of him that they didn't want him to leave. They just wanted to look at his beauty. So they were all like totally, do you remember Bambi? Twitter-pated? They were totally just overawed by Shaul's shocking beauty and how handsome this man is. So they just started talking. So each girl was like looking at him, staring at the most handsome young man they've ever met, and they all start like speaking different parts. Well, he's here, he's there, but if you miss it, he's going to be up at the feast, go now, he's there, right? And they all start talking disjointedly because they're like, wow. And the rabbis actually say, but this is Saul. Clearly it's a motivator. Okay, that's the cute part.
Which one does he marry?
None of them, actually. Oh. He gets someone else. Someone else. Okay. I love it. So the rabbis, and another cute thing, say, by the way, if this ever happens to you, you are destined for greatness. If you ever come somewhere and meet a group of gaggling girls and they start like just, you know, like you're a rock star and they start like, you know, talking, then you are in for big stuff like Shaul was. You're destined to become.
But that's modern day. You meet people at the well. And they're drawing water.
Absolutely. You noticed they were going to draw water.
Just find the well.
Rebecca by the well. Rachel by the well. Sipporah by the well. Right? Today we go by the well. We have our coffee or our drinks at the big hotel in Manhattan. That's the well. Very well said. I love it, Jason. That's great. You notice he pointed out they were going to draw water. Absolutely. Well said, Jason. Sorry.
Oh,
that's right. Yikes. Okay. So, right. So on the light note then, the girls are stunned by his beauty. And again, the rabbis say, by the way, this happens to you, good portent. It's going to be good for you in the future. Now on a beautiful thing. Why did the girls speak disjointedly in a practical way? Why was it necessary to waste our valuable time with these three verses? And more importantly, why was it important to sort of waste Saul's valuable time? Rabbi said, no, you don't understand. As soon as Saul and Samuel and Saul meet up, it will officially end the reign of Samuel's kingship, so to speak, as the leader. And Saul's will begin. And guess what? There were 45 seconds left in the reign of Samuel. And God says, I will not detract even michuta sara, even a hair's breadth from the reign of one deserving individual, that we should prematurely end his reign so someone else takes over. So the girls are sent specifically to Ma'akev to prevent Saul, for those whatever how many seconds they prevented them, from accomplishing what he's going to do, is meeting Samuel. The time was not right. God says, the girls, okay, go schmooze, go talk, delay, whatever you do. Okay, now it's time, get up there, meet Samuel. So it's a beautiful idea that Meherafayim, literally by the blink of an eye, God has predestined things in the fabric of our nature, of our world. We know, for example, in the year 2448, on the 15th day of Nisan, when it was the time for the Geula, the redemption from Egypt, it was to the second. Not one second was added on to the slavery. Boom. Same thing here. It is immoral for God to detract from Samuel's reign. So therefore, the girls are there by design to prevent even 45 seconds or 15 seconds taken away from Samuel. Okay, so the gaggle of girls leaves, and then what happens? Vayalu Ayir, verse 14, Yud Dalet. So they go up to the city, Hema Boyim Besoch Ayir, and behold, they are coming up into the midst of the city, to the marketplace. Vihine Shmuel Yotzei Likrasam. Oh my gosh! Samuel is coming to greet them. They're going to look for the seer, and he's seeking them. La'alos habama, to go up to the high place in the city.
now we say, oh, by the way, you want to know the rest of the story, Mr. Paul Harvey? Well, here's the rest of the story. You see, it wasn't a coincidence. It was a setup. Tesfav. For Hashem gala es ozen Shmuel. You see, God had revealed to the ear of Samuel, Yom Echad, previously one day, Lifnei vo Shaul Emor, before the coming of Saul, saying, Ka'es machar, set your watch, set your sundial, Mr. Samuel, because tomorrow at this moment, Eshloch Elecha Ish Me'eretz Binyamin. I, God says to Samuel, will send you 24 hours from now a young man from the land of Benjamin, Umishachto. He is my Mashiach. He is my anointed one, because remember, they anointed kings with oil. Linagi, to lead Al Ami Yisrael, over my nation of Israel. V'hoshias Amimi Aplishtin. He will save, rescue my people from the hand of the Philistines. Ki ra'isi es ami, because I have seen my nation. Ki ba'at sa'akaso elai, their cries have come up to me in heaven. Ushmuel ra'a es Shaul. So Samuel sees Saul. V'hashem anahu. And boom, God spoke up to him. He answered him. Hinei ha'ish. Here is the man, God says to Samuel. Asher amarti elecha, about whom I spoke to you. Zeh yatzor ba'ami. This is the man who will rule over my people. Now this is a mind-bending moment, because obviously, tribe of Benjamin, in lieu of what I shared with you earlier tonight, by Pilegish Begiva, the horrific nature of the history of Benjamin, that a Benjaminite should be chosen to be the first king of Israel, really? Obviously, Samuel has no issue here because it's God. So what happens? Now, Saul's not privy to what happened yesterday between God and Samuel. So he approaches Samuel in the midst of the gate of the city. He says, excuse me, sir, please tell me, where is the house of this seer? I love it. So Samuel says to Saul, Vayomer, and he says, hey, Anochi Haro'ah, I'm the one you seek. I'm the Jedi you seek. I'm the seer. Alele fanai habama, come up before me to the high place of the city. V'chaltem imi hayom, you will eat with me today. V'shilachticha baboker, I will send you on your way in the next morning. V'chol and all, asher bilvavcho, everything that is in your heart, is like the shadow. Agidlach, I will tell you. Let's stop right now. So just to wrap up, beautiful, beautiful. So, first of all, Samuel's taken to task in a very gentle way by the rabbis. Because remember how he said to Saul, I'm the Roel? Anochi doesn't mean ani. Ani is I am. Anochi is this is who I am, what I am. Anochi, like we would say with God's first commandment, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, right? This is who I am. I am existentially the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. So God did not really like Samuel bragging, because Samuel really could have said, you know, I have powers, but biladai, they come from God. So because of a 0.01% of hubris perhaps had entered into that statement, even though I don't think, God forbid, Samuel intended it, later on there's going to be a scene where he gets to meet the real first king of Israel, David. The only thing is, God doesn't tell him which son. He says, you know, there's a guy named Yishai, Jesse, and he has a bunch of sons. How about you go, you figure out who's the king? And so he meets the oldest son. He says, ah, this is the guy. He's tall, he's handsome. God says, you call yourself the seer? It's going to be the little kid with the red hair out with the sheepola that you're not even paying attention to. You see what a great seer you are? So it's a little bit of a payback, because Samuel had the effrontery, if you will, to announce to the world and to Saul that I'm the seer. God says, let's see how well you see. You only see superficially because you're human. I see what's in a person's heart. So that's one little addendum. So again, everything that has happened from the lost donkeys, by the way, I know you're going to have sleepless nights till next Monday night, so fear not. Samuel, in the next verse, says, by the way, the donkeys, they were found a couple days ago, so relax. So Dad's happy, the cars are back in the garage, everything's back to normal. I knew you would have loose sleepless nights, right? Next week, please God, we'll be together, and we will find out the future destiny of this great king of Israel, King Saul. Everyone, Erev Tov.